Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today as I'm rejoined here on the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast by Tom Lane, who is coming back to talk more about the Yuta Tono Codex, which is a Mesoamerican document that describes the ritual use of ingestion of psilocybin mushrooms and gaining access to what is now being called time persons, which Tom is going to explain about in our talk. We actually had this interview several months ago now, and I've already released the talk on YouTube along with some of the images that he is discussing, and I'm going to put a link to that YouTube video in the description of the podcast here if you want to go check that out. So some of you may have already seen the video and listened to that, and if that's the case, well, you can listen again or just tune in next week as I'll be sharing another selection from the Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT Anthology. But before we get into the talk with Tom for this week, I do have some announcements to make and some thanks to make. So let's go ahead and get into that, and we'll get into the talk with Tom in just a few minutes here. So first of all, I would like to thank the Beehive Ashram, who has come back as a patron over at my Patreon page. Thank you very much for your returning and your continued support over there. Also, big thanks to Joel, who joined as a new patron at the CAP level, which gets him a 30-minute consultation call with me once a month. Patreon is a great way to support me and to support this podcast. There's a link to my Patreon page at the top right of my personal webpage, martinball.net, or you can go directly there. Go to patreon.com/martinwball, and there is everything from $1 a month all the way up to $100 a month, which also gets you a one-hour consultation call with me on a monthly basis. And coming in from PayPal over the past couple weeks, had a couple donations there. A nice donation from Nick, thank you very much. And a generous donation both from Ed and from Bent. Thank you very much for that support. It is very much appreciated. And as I always say, this is an independent, listener-supported podcast. If you're out there and if you'd like to throw a little support my way, you can do that via PayPal or signing up over at Patreon. And just a reminder, at Patreon, there's no commitment. You can come and go, just like the Beehive Ashram. You can come and go as it suits you and as you're available or interested in supporting. Stay as long as you like. Get the benefits that come with your level. And just a reminder that all of the old episodes of the podcast that are no longer available actively here are available over at Patreon for those who sign up at the $20 a month and up level. And there's well over 100 episodes that are over there. Okay, on to the next topic. I have been away from home over the past couple of weeks and pretty much left home the day after posting the My Scarlet Letter podcast episode about the damage that's been done to my reputation via symposia and the ongoing damage and cancellation that has taken place there and the barriers that have been put in place between me and my ability to participate in wider psychedelic culture in terms of even being able to give talks, to join educational events and things like that. And just wanted to say a few things about that now that I'm back home and current with what's taken place since then. So first of all, I just want to thank everyone who listened to the podcast and especially thank anybody who shared the podcast and encouraged others to listen to the podcast. When I initially posted it on Monday morning on Facebook, one person liked it and nothing happened. And so I reposted it on Tuesday and that one definitely got some attention and it got spread very widely. And a lot of people made comments and reached out and got in touch with me. And I just want to say thank you to everyone. A lot of people actually were quite surprised that they didn't know that the damage that had been done by Symposia was as extensive and as thorough as it actually has become. Even people who were aware of what took place with Symposia 2.5 years ago when this originally took place didn't know that this was still an ongoing issue for me and it's still creating barriers for me to participate and share and educate and, you know, continue to be myself and make a living doing so. So I'm glad that people are more aware now. And I will say that, you know, I put a lot of thought into crafting that essay and putting out that podcast episode. And as I said in the episode, there really wasn't much new that I was sharing there. But it really, I'd encountered that wall of quote unquote, you're an abuser or you were unethical or whatever, however people want to characterize it. been encountering that so much recently that it was really on my mind, to where I was thinking about all the things that I wanted to say all the time and what I wanted people to hear, and hopefully open some ears and open some minds. And putting out that podcast episode and getting all the responses that I did helps me to feel heard and seen, and has lessened the internal pressure that's going on about, I want to say something about all of this. So I'm really grateful for all of that. And certainly some people have reached out and said, hey, well, you know, I'm just one person. I don't know what I can do. So I have just a few things that I would share with you, my listening audience. And of course, there's no grand solution to this here, because cancel culture and the enforcement of labels and sort of the pressure to, well, if this person is called an abuser, everybody has to agree with that, or you're somehow enabling this abuse, or you're an apologist or whatever, that is much more widespread than me and my case, that this is something that has infiltrated all aspects of modern American and Western culture. It's quite pervasive. So it's much bigger than me and my issue with Symposia. But when it does come to me that there are a few things that people can do that are perhaps small, but can also perhaps make a difference. So one, I would say, like Tom Lane, in seeing the podcast episode, he went to his Facebook group and he made a statement of support for me and saying that he felt that I had been mischaracterized by Symposia. And I really appreciate that, Tom, that he has a nice audience on Facebook. So that's something that people can do if you're someone who has an audience on social media, and if you feel like making a statement of support, then that's great. And a few other people did that on Facebook as well. And of course, as I said, many people shared the podcast episode. And I encourage people to continue sharing it, especially when you encounter a situation where someone or an organization says Martin Ball's an ethical abuser. And I'll just give you another example of that, that there's another individual that I've been working with on a variety of different things. And he told me about how he was participating in an online course for spiritual leadership. And it was all done over Zoom. And he told me that this is one of the examples that really came to my attention, was he said that this wasn't even any way connected with psychedelics or the psychedelic world, but on this course that was being offered online, that the organizers and the people running the course put my name up on Zoom and said, and here's an example of a corrupt and abusive spiritual leader. And he immediately broke into the Zoom call and he said, hey, this is not cool. I know Martin personally. I've worked with him. And what you're saying here is just not correct, and that he has been slandered and defamed by Symposia. And you're repeating that without actually looking into what the situation really was. So taking stands like that, again, it's small, but it can make a difference over long-term impact. Just a couple other things that I would mention is, you know, if you've purchased one of my books, I would invite you to leave a review on Amazon. And if you feel so inspired, if you want to say something, that if you feel that my work has been mischaracterized publicly, you can include that in your review. That, you know, part of what I'm trying to do here is just really be open and upfront about this. And I'm encouraging other people as well to not hide from the issue, but actually confront it and say, hey, we think that this has been unfair. And of course, I don't want to put words into your mouth or into your hands, but if you feel so inspired. Also, just anybody out there listening who has ever worked with me in any capacity, either back in my days of facilitation or as an integration client, feel free to send me an endorsement or a review. And that's something that I've been collecting over the past few weeks from my integration clients, and I've received a number of very positive responses from people there. And I've been sharing those on social media. And again, it's just about helping to shift the perspective that, you know, can't control anybody's perspective on anything, but it's about providing counter information that says, hey, Martin Ball is actually a decent guy and he's got something to contribute that's of value. And so if you feel inspired to do anything like that, then I invite you to do so. Then, of course, there is my Patreon page, that there is quote unquote power in numbers. And, you know, I'd invite more people to come over to my Patreon page and sign up as a patron, even at the $1 a month level. You know, that's not a lot of money, but just getting more people, that shows, like, there are people out there who support me and who are aware that I have been accused by Symposia of being this psychopathic sexual predator, which I am not, and we're standing up for me and for truth. So I don't want to just ramble on about this. I do want to get to the talk with Tom, but just for everybody who's taken steps like that and gone out of their way, which of course is, you know, what people are doing, that no one needs to do this, but for everyone who's gone out of their way to share my story, share this information, to make a statement in support of me and my work, and push back against the abuse of Symposia and those who have followed in their wake, I deeply, 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 deeply appreciate it. And I, you know, can't do it without you guys, because you are my audience, and you're the only ones that I have to talk to. And oh, also, you know, if you have a local group of people that would be interested in speaking with me, we can always organize an online Zoom event where, you know, I can talk with your local group. I've had a number of people do that, that, you know, I'm not really expecting to be invited to any major conferences or anything like that, because organizations don't want to get on Symposia's hit list. They don't want to be associated with me. But if we could do more smaller local groups, I'm always happy to do that. If somebody has a show, a podcast, a YouTube channel, I'm always happy to be an interview subject. And it doesn't have to be about Symposia. It doesn't have to be about the controversy, but I've got a lot more to share as well. And I'm always happy to do that. And I'm appreciative of, recently I have had some interview requests and invitations, and gotten a chance to share and be myself, and really appreciate that. So I just have a lot of gratitude. I'm really appreciative of what everyone has shared and reached out, and just want you to know that. And I'm sorry that I've been speaking for a little bit long before getting into this talk with Tom, but we're just about ready there. I do want to say that Tom and I had a rather long conversation. And so what I've done is I've edited the conversation to really keep it on track for talking about the Utah Tono Codex. So there's some jumps in the conversation here and there, and there's a few odd edits, but I've tried to condense it down to, it's a little bit over an hour. And again, there is the link to the YouTube video if you want to see the actual images that we're talking about. And, again, if you heard my podcast with Tom from a few years ago now, that a lot of this is along the same lines, but there's some new information that's being inserted in here. So it's kind of a continuation of our earlier conversation. And if you want the older conversation, that is available at the Entheogenic Evolution Archive over at my Patreon page. And of course, one last thing is just to remind you that I am available always for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations to help you integrate your entheogenic experience from a non-dual and energetic perspective. And you're always welcome to reach out about that. Just send me an email at martinwball@gmail.com or stop by at nondualentheogenicintegration.com. Okay, enough said. Thank you for bearing with me. Let's go ahead and get into the conversation with Tom Lane. This is from a few months ago. And again, we're talking about the Utah Tnoho Codex. That's Y-U-T-A-T-N-O-H-O Codex. So you can look that up online if you want to. Okay, next week, another chapter from Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT, and then more interviews after that. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for listening. If you don't mind, I'd like to give a little preface for what we're going to be talking about today, kind of a little bit of a summary. So previously, it was a few years ago now, had you here on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, and we talked about the Utah Tono Codex, and we were talking about its relationship to Quetzalcoatl, the concept of the deified heart, and of course, work with psilocybin mushrooms in Mesoamerican cultures. And so we're going to be talking more about this today and kind of giving a new reading on the whole thing. So I wanted to sort of briefly summarize what this new reading is and why it's significant for understanding this document. And you're going to give us lots more details about all of this, so I'm just going to be brief and summarize. But basically, what we're working with here, and we're going to be showing this image in the video that we're making, and I'll also be using it as the cover for just the audio podcast so that people can just look at the cover, and we'll also make it available elsewhere for people to get. But this is, the idea is that this codex, these images that we're going to be talking about, this is not a language. These are not glyphs. These are not symbols. This is not something to be read. This is not something to be deciphered. But it's more of a living representation that when mushrooms are consumed in a specific way, which you're going to be talking about, that this, these images then become like vibratory emanations that can then enter one into a visionary experience of interacting with Quetzalcoatl, interacting with Tlaloc, interacting with these various deities, which we're not saying that these are just archetypes in the collective unconscious of humanity, but actually that they are emanations from the mushrooms themselves, that this is a mushroom dependent experience. And for those who regularly listen to the podcast, this is what Jessica Marie was sharing about from her experience with you of taking the mushrooms in this specific way that you're going to be sharing about, looking at the images on the codex, looking at the images on the paper, where they started to vibrate and then they emerged out of the codex itself and then entered her into a complete visionary experience where then it is an interactive space with these vibratory forms and emanations. And so that's kind of the snapshot of what we're going to be talking about today. And you will provide the clarifications and corrections to anything that I perhaps mischaracterized.
Somebody said, let's go to Marlon Demandos and try to save Mario Sabini. Yeah, and I said, I'll end up in a Mexican jail. And he said, no, we can do it. I've got a slip from some government agency for a day. We can be there. No, I don't want to do that. I said, okay, I'll throw the I Ching, and I threw the I Ching. And it came out I should go, and I said, I'm going to throw it again. I threw it again. And you only believe this even the change in numbers come up. And that's where I met my wife. But I met her at basically the ceremony with Maria Sabina. We went up with about two or three other people super, super early in the morning. And it took a long time to climb up there. They call that place the Eagle's Nest. She's way up higher almost than anybody else on the way to the Sacred Hills and all the shrine and stuff. And so we got up there. And we agreed that night to do a ceremony with Maria. Maria and her family agreed to it. And believe it or not, there's only one person that spoke Spanish, a little kid. All of Maria's children only spoke Mazatec. But she had a grandson that spoke Spanish. And so we could speak Spanish to the grandson.
And he would translate for you guys?
He would tell us what his mother was saying.
Yeah.
Or his grandmother was saying. Because he knew Mazatec, which is a tonal language. You know what a tonal language is, right?
Yes, I'm familiar.
You're a musician. You got to know what a tonal language is. Her daughter really participated in Apollonia. Apollonia would be making sounds of birds. She'd be making sounds of rain falling. But the biggest thing, and I can't express it to this, and this is going to sound almost sacrilegious, but it'd be like sometimes encouraging her mother, like a sports fan telling their favorite team or player to get it on, play hard, just like almost like she was saying, shamatize, mama, shamatize. And she would dance, and she'd do ventriloquy. But the most amazing thing was when she first came around to each one of us, she would practice again and again till she could say our name just like we said it. Now, this is the most amazing thing in the world. But the last time I was looking at her eyes closer than you'd almost like nose to nose, and I'm a hillbilly from Northeast Tennessee, right? Very few people sound like me, like the people from Northeast Tennessee. When she said it that last time, it was like, I'm not sure. I thought I said it. I'm not kidding you. I'm not kidding you. It sort of jerked me. You have a little body jerk.
Yeah.
And it was like a recognition. And that night you could hear different names bouncing around in the ethers of the person's name. And it sounded like they had said it. I think it has to do with breath, understanding your breath, you know, and your breathing, like when you say your name. And I guess when you say your name to you, I don't know, that's a lot of subjects we could go off into. But, you know, the most ancient things was to say your name, your breath. That was to say, like, the name of God. And a lot of religions, everybody knew what that name was. But in certain ceremonies, only like the shaman or the curandero could say the name. It wasn't just supposed to be said so anybody heard it but the members of the tribe. That's how the Huichols are.
So was this your first introduction to psilocybin mushrooms with Maria Sabina?
Oh, no. I'd eaten mushrooms with Mayans over in near Palenque.
So you got introduced then to the psilocybin mushrooms before the work with Maria Sabina. At what point, you know, I think it's safe to say at this point that you are very devoted to sharing information about psilocybin mushrooms, and particularly the context in which they are used in Mesoamerican cultures. You're very interested in sort of these ancient lineages and ancient practices. At what point did you decide that this was going to be your focus, that this is what you wanted to do and what you wanted to communicate to the world about?
I think I just have. I haven't ever really thought. I've just felt like I've told a lot of people what I thought was the truth.
Yeah. So when did you take up, for example, the Yuta Tono and really start looking at these materials, these archaeological treasures, right? That obviously a lot of the codices, they were burned by the Spanish. They were destroyed. They really tried to suppress the indigenous religion. But some of these things, you know, have survived, such as the Yuta Tono Codex. So when did you become interested in these and wanting to study these and understand what they're really about?
Well, after I wrote my first book, I realized, I think you haven't written any books that are worthwhile since your first book. It was such a masterpiece, that one you wrote on mushrooms, okay? I'm just kidding. But I read James Maffey's, saw a couple of videos on him, and I got a couple of books by him, started reading them. And then I had an epiphany. I realized that at 72 years old, I've been talking to some people, you know, just the week before, like Robert Jordan. Okay, I talked to him just a couple of weeks before. We talked about seeing these different types of emanations. And so all of a sudden, I'm reading Maffey, and what he is describing is what you would call the Tamaline male and the Tonalpe females that were the mushroom sages' view of reality, called the Teal, or Teal. It's not deified. No capital letter, okay? And there's only been two other, what you'd say, pantheistic, monistic philosophies ever in the world besides this, the Natwa Teol, and that's the Polynesian Mana and the Tao Te Ching concept of Chi, you know, the microcosmic orbit, okay, through the center of the body and everything. Well, this part of what's called, there's 40 different type of talents these people had. You can't compare them to anybody you hear about in Europe or the names for things over there. But they had 40 different special talents that a lot of people had when they took sacred mushrooms, or in different ways that they took them, even rubbing on their skin. And there were some big, huge festivals where they used them. But the Yuta Tono Codex, what made it special was when I realized that you have to realize what you're seeing pantheistically is when you're what's called the mushroom, the reality. And there's a different concept of time, space, and man and women. And that's why you've got to really, if you don't understand that, you're thinking about it dualistically, you know, and you'll never, and even non-dualism is still coming from Western dualism, right? Monism is like a continuum, just swinging back and forth, but it's always flowing. And see, the thing about it swinging back and forth is like a pendulum swinging back and forth, or maybe a metronome. But the idea is that the sage is balanced, that you're trying to balance your life. That's why men and women weren't really separated. There was a time when they considered women a warrior man and a man, a woman. And so there was this thing like, okay, the interaction, we're trying to stay balanced. If I'm a male or I'm a female, then I'm going to try to stay balanced with what I can do. You know what my gifts and talents are, right? There's no beginning. There's no ending. There's no gods. But these saw these when they took Teotihuacan, which was the flesh of the sacrificial blood from Quetzalcoatl, the female male sky dragon that these children grew from this flesh and blood when lightning hit the earth. See, these traditions go all the way back. As a religion, we know it goes forward because, and I was still just down there yet last year, the Zapotecans are doing more mushrooms in the mountains than they ever did before because they're not afraid of the federales now.
So maybe this is a good time then to explain this concept of the time persons, that just based on what you've shared with me. So this is kind of going back into my little preface and summary, this idea that these are not archetypes, and they're not characters in mythology. For example, the way that we might compare, say, Greek and Roman mythology of, oh, they've got all these gods and goddesses, and we've got all these different stories and these different ceremonies and different ways of worshiping them or whatever. But these are emanations from the mushroom experience themselves. And that,
what they're showing you is this is supposed to become alive.
Yeah.
This is Hechicheral. The sorcery itself is in when you take the mushrooms, you can send and meditate on these pictures before you take them, or you can take them when you're there. Or you can learn to see them, and then you know what you're, who you're seeing and what this is about when you're about later. Because James Matthey, who's just retired, a professor emeritus at the University of Maryland, and also studied in anthropology. And recently he did a video, which there's done many, many videos, but I think why you like this video, and you saw that video, is on the talking book, the Tonatli. He's presented to the entire world that the Nahuas, which included the Mexica, who became the Aztecs, the Mixtecs, the Zapotecs, the Chimichecs, the Mixi. Okay, all these Nahua tribal groups that all spoke Nahuatl, you know, knew about these sacred books. But we're into this concept of what is called the Teot, just like the Chinese were into Tao Te Ching, some of the key energy, okay? But they were using mushrooms in temples to try to unmask some of the secrets of reality that had to do with physical healing, and they would progress through physical healing to mental healing or spiritual healing. And this is the thing. It was a type of thing to ignite your spine, to cause your spine to vibrate and your body to start humming. So it's healing itself by the breathing techniques your body's naturally doing, by getting you to breathe deeply and with your blood, you know, to actually use your life force and the life force within the energy to heal your body physically.
And this is exclusively in conjunction with consumption of mushrooms.
Yeah. Now sometimes tobacco is rubbed on the skin. Sometimes tobacco is rubbed on the skins. Sometimes dirt's rubbed on the legs, like Maria did. Sabina, but rubbed tobacco on the inner parts of my arms, you know, a poultice from that old stuff, and some dirt on my knees, on both knees. But the thing of it is, in this book, The Yutatona, it is the only complete creation story that escaped the Spanish fires. Cortez stole this in the encyclopedia, which is a story apart in this book, too, from Cortez's library. They weren't done by the Mixica, which later became known as the Aztec. They were done by the Mixtec near Oaxaca, near two cities, based on a sacred ceremonial that came from a cave. And what this is on page 24, an ancient sage that's human and really old is asking Quetzalcoatl on a ceremonial throne to give all this knowledge to humans. Will he give all this knowledge to the Mixtecs? Will he give it to humans? And there's two river spirits down there where this sacred cave are, Nuhus, and you'll learn about them later, but they're all going back and forth about, should humans get this? Should they learn about the spirits of the river? Should they learn about the spirits of the land? Should they learn about, you know, these energy spirits, which is like saying, learn about a hurricane, an energy thing, a storm coming in. These are energy, motion, power that you can perceive, you know, for healing and other purposes. So you say, yeah, we'll do it. We'll do it. We'll do it. And then in the story, as it goes on, right behind Lord Tudal, this ancient sage, is Four Lizard, who represents the sacred mushrooms in the earth, the sacred mushrooms coming out, the blood of the earth coming out from the growth below. The Sun Prince, you know, is coming up. In other words, this is the rebirth of the Sun Prince. Now, right behind Quetzalcoatl, you'll see this jaguar on a throne, and that's the throne of the courage, the, you know, your throne of being alive on this earth and joyous, and the throne of living now, and the courage to go through this ceremony. Now, down below, it's sort of a symbol for eternity down there, which is like the A with the squash going through with all those hanging beads right beside the Nuhus, who are beside the river right below Quetzalcoatl. Now, that river, you notice in there, it's wavy, right? Choppy. Mm-hmm. And you notice the guy's hands, there's three reeds that are untied. And certain things are flowing. Well, this is the idea that your life's not in balance. You're really not in a balanced person in life. In other words, you haven't balanced the male, female in you yet. And you're living a life in chaos and rather than just going with the flow, like maybe thou let so go with the flow, you know, don't get out there and fight the river, whatever. But then the most amazing thing is when you go up to the next scene where you have Four Lizard, his mushrooms have changed in color. Now this means something. All these colors represent something. Now, when you see these colors, there's three things to remember, really important, okay? One is red and black are the most sacred colors. That means something's really sacred if it's red or black, and together, red and black. Okay, now also, green is representative of things that are bursting with life and coming from life. You know, Wasson in his books made a big thing about the caps all being green, right? Jade green. They represent a special ethnogenic sort of a thing in power. And in the picture, which you're seeing there, he's walking toward the Valley of the Ancient Ancestors. He's pointing above and below to Taloc to open up the world of the ancient ancestors. And he's got a staff in front of him floating in the air. And that staff is like made from something when lightning hit the earth, and it's sort of like announcing he's coming into the ancient underworld. And Lady Four Lizard is on his back now, but she's only got three mushrooms on her. And in a weaving arc over Quetzalcoatl, you see the actual Four Lizard with a tail swirling back in a quarter of a circle over Quetzalcoatl and Lady Four Lizard. That's mean he's taken the mushrooms. And he's gotten with the actual spirit of the mushroom on the back there. That would be like the same as Maria Sabina. In other words, with that knowledge, right? You got knowledge of what this world's about and what you're going to go through. And Quetzalcoatl is looking at Taloc, which he can shapeshift into. But down below Taloc, the green figure is something like corn. You see the corn?
Yeah.
It's sitting on a pedestal. And that corn represents living food, life, which the Curandero has always told me, the sacred mushroom is food just like any other food. We eat mushrooms for food. It is food. Everything is food first. And then the symbol in front of that, you see the A with the little dot?
Yes.
Okay, that's a symbol for the beginning of time. Now, this is crazy because there is no beginning of time and there's no end of time in this thing. It's a constant flow. Almost like they talk about in quantum physics and our quantum mechanics, you know, a constant flow of flux. but still it represents the beginning of time. And I think it's like on page 2, it represents the beginning of their time as a people. Okay. You know, that when they took their elders, took this in a cave in a sacred ceremony, and they became what's called here. I'll read this to you. It's really beautiful. The holy avatars of the earth and I, these children were born of light under the people of light. The people of light are the people for God of light from the consumption of Tomochi. Sacred mushrooms were of enormous importance in the Uteotan religious ceremonial rituals of the Mixtecs, Mazatecans, Zapotecans, and the Mayans. And so you see this thing, it was the idea from the first sunrise is a mysterious origin of humans by natural, supernatural forces of deifying their heart to become a real human.
Yeah, so this is about essentially the beginnings of enculturation, of actually moving into a culture with a tradition, with a set of knowledge, a set of practices.
And dynasties with kings and queens, right, and connection between other tribes. And then like the Europeans, you know, that married their cousins and everything, the Mayans and the Anahuac tribes would send one of their daughters to another tribe or a son to another tribe because they felt like the intermarrying of the rulership between the tribes, the dynasties of kings and queens and that stuff would keep there from being wars and keep the peace. This is a story of how these people came from a sacred tree on that river, which is called, some people call it the storytelling river, or the place where the gods came from. Because the first 23 pages are all about the gods in a creation story, and all these, they're spirits of nature. They're not like Egyptian, Roman, Hindu, Christian, Hebrew, nothing like that. They're like energy forces within nature, like the Chinese Tao Te Ching would talk about, or the Polynesian Mana. Well, they could unmask these things and talk to them and be involved with them because they came out of Teo Nautacatl. They came out of the mushroom. There were, and that's the most crazy thing. When Mappy was talking to these, a lot of these women and men that were all on this video, you can see, he was saying at the Lund, it said that, they were using mushrooms and they were using olakia, and there's no doubt that they were using mushrooms and olakia and peyote. And he said, you know, there's a lot of argument over whether they took the mushrooms and met these talking people, these spirits out in the world, or were these spirits in the plant themselves? And if you took them, you would experience, you know, these people that were unique to this plant, like, you know, peyote has unique people, mescalero, everything, you know, I've done it a few times. I don't want to talk about it now, but, you know, so these are, I believe, are unique to the plants, and the people that I've told them to take it the way this is shown in this ceremony will tell you it takes you directly to this world for these people to come off this particular page. Now, this was done on deer skin. And very special female and male sages were known as the people who know things, who were also artists, okay? They were chosen to draw these things so they would have a shamanic action when you took mushrooms and look at them, that they would literally become alive off the page, and you could get help from them. You could get things in the spiritual world. You could get healing. You could get more of the divination, but not like people think of it. This happens in the future. More like, okay, these are two rivers in life, and I can tell you what's down this river, and I can tell you what's down this river, but I can't tell you what's going to happen exactly to you on either river. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's life choices.
Yeah. So if I could just make like a really crude analogy. So again, in looking at these images right here, that we have all this different iconography, we've got all these different figures, but the page itself. So when you take the mushrooms and you're interacting with this page, it's again, this is a very crude analogy, but it's almost like we're looking at an iPad or some kind of smartphone, and that these are app icons. And then by taking the mushrooms, you're actually clicking on the app icon, and then you're entering into a virtual 3D space where then you are able to interact with these different energies and receive what it is that they, the potential that they bring, these potentials for, as you say, physical healing, mental healing, and divination of seeing the pathways of causality that might lead you down one road or another. So that this is like a kind of mushroom technology, in a sense, that becomes interactive. That, like, one of the terms that I've used in my work is that by ingesting entheogens, we're able to enter into our personal interface with the divine, that this opens up the potential to have these kinds of interactions and these kinds of energetic exchanges, and that this is a template for these different beings, these energetic signatures that you might then be interacting with. Does that work as an analogy?
Yeah. If you would be dancing and playing a guitar while you said that as a song, it would be better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly how they did it, man. They didn't, these things are just incredible. There's one page I want to read you about just a festival that happened in the night. And it's written about by these Mexicans talking about this sacred dark temple of Yodel, where there was what they call at night, they gathered, you know, around there, these different types of priests, male and females, but they prepared a vessel, which is an hallucinogenic ointment of ointment, which included scorpions and rattlesnake venom. And from the ashes, and those were all over their body at night. And they put this on there to be able to speak to time persons. But a later stage, we see this when they open what's called a sacred bundle in the plaza, something that's been gathered up sacred and sanctified at their ceremonies in there. And it starts with what's called in this temple, smoke eyes. It's a trance-like vision with all these black bodies painted, and all they're seeing their eyes, and they're getting ready to go out at night, and they've dropped a little sacrificial blood to the mushrooms into the avatar of Lord Night of the dreams. Now, this dropping of blood on mushrooms was often done just when they were a little dry to pump them up. They actually had accept them as water coming into them. And they would take this, and there was a temple called the Temple of the Eagle. And there was a sacred bundle that was taken to a sacred robe by priests. And these priests were wizards of both the good and dark side, like you call maybe Christ or the devil, you know, representing the two forces of nature. And at night, they were going to open up this bundle, you know, on the down there. But when they're going out there, they have this guy that's playing a ball game coming out of this temple at night with one of these time persons who represents darkness, you know, one of their wizards, you know, he's going to beat him in a ball game and cast him out from being involved with the festival tomorrow. And all of a sudden they break open the bundle, and it said divine power broke loose. But the next day, as it comes up, there's a winding serpentine parade through Teotihuacan with people playing drums, dancing, people on mushrooms, and wizards going shooting from the top of one temple down into the parade, and people shooting back up in fireballs, you know, in an entire mushroom parade celebrating all these different type of deities. But this book, when you get up to it on the line that's the most important, which people talk about all the time, and a lot of people get it wrong. They get certain parts right, but they get certain parts wrong, is Quetzalcoatl has severed the head of death. And I'm not going to say his name because I'd embarrass myself trying to say that long name of the head of death, but he severed the head of death. And he created a special instrument to play during sacred mushroom ceremonies. And he's scraping across the head of death while he's singing the song of the sun. He's selling the celebration of life to come and the song of the sun.
Just to clarify, so this is about the third set of images up the right-hand side of the
right
page? Okay.
Right. Quetzalcoatl is sitting down more flat-like now. and you see right in front of him Sochapelli sitting on a mat in jaguar skin. Now, he has another very special name for him, and he can shape-shift into his sister, Sochapelli, or her back into him. But it's also, he's representing humans. He's a proxy for humans, the same as at the Stellas, the Sochicalico, two of them. People argue over whether it's a human face or his face in there. Some people think it's Sochapelli is a proxy. Some people think it's a human face. Well, anyway, he's sitting there with tears in his eyes because this has been given to humans. On the previous page, he was going to see if he could come there and get this to happen. And it was. And you see behind him, the one, the Nuhus of the river, the spirits of the river and plants are giving their blessing to this. And the one part I discovered behind it was this particular insect and its little feathers and everything. People thought it's a cricket. It's not a cricket. It's the sacred bee that made the honey in Mexico, what they call a stingless wasp or bee that actually makes this little thin cone of honey. I ate some of this with a curandero, Francisco Ramírez, in the mountains there. But in this ceremony, he's accepting this to go into physical resurrection and rejuvenation and a spiritual rebirth and to learn about these from these different, and people have talents in this. You mentioned this before. The first thing I should have said after you start talking all about this is the priest and the priestess, the Tonalti women who were priestess in the Tamil and men, priests, sages and stuff, they considered that dance, music, all these things were better to tell the story. But more importantly, what you said earlier about people, they considered 40 different categories of talents people could get from the mushroom, 40 different talents, all involving in healing and stuff or divination or something like that, that, you know, that was more like advice sort of thing, like Dear Abby type of advice in a way. Okay, here's what happened to you, Martin, if you go over there. Here's what lies over there. Think about this, blah, 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 without judgment. Because as your life goes forward, there's nobody making any judgment. That's what can blow people away. Nobody's making any judgment. And these are all your friends. And what blows me away is Western people are taught like this duality. Oh, my God, there's a monster. Well, if you love them, if you express good feelings, I say it's like finding an old friend to me. They need friends. It's like if you get into Nahua Curandismo, they don't think like this Freudian thing. They think it's a whole family thing, but they think the relationship with these people, that they need humans. They need humans to honor them. They need to talk to humans, let them know what's going on in the world, you know? They need us and we need them. And so we're going incantations. You're telling them what you want, almost like, hey, Martin, I want this now, man. This is what I want. I want it. And I really want it now. How can I do something? What can I do for you? I brought these flowers. I brought this here to, you know, or out in the world or wherever, you know, it's a type of, you're honoring them and they're honoring you. And they're the connection to certain types of this energy, power motion that comes in the body. Now, especially when it's from Quetzalcoatl, the night before in this ceremony, they would take chocolate, you know, or they might take it in the morning, you know, all types of cacao really cooked up, you know, because this was to get all the happiness going. I always do that before a ceremony, you know, a lot of chocolate after I do fast for a while, and then I do chocolate. But then when you're getting the sacred mushrooms, there's a lot of ceremonies, blowing trumpets to the east, facing the east, honoring the sun, you know, honoring the four parts of nature just that exist, north, south, east, and west, and whatever's been important to you in your life, you know, that you found. Maybe it was an eagle feather on the road. I don't even know, but whatever's important, you honor those sort of things, and with the mushrooms, and when later, at noon or in the evening, sometime when it's decided by the group, start eating the mushrooms with dipping them in a cup of honey and putting them in your mouth. Keep getting one or two, saying a blessing, put them in the honey, you know, put them in your mouth, and you chew and you chew and you chew, and you keep your lips up almost like Xochipilli in the museum in Mexico, and you don't open your mouth. When this happens in your mouth, when it goes to your stomach, and you know all this, we're not going to get into the medical, but 80% gets destroyed in the liver, okay, of what gets through. The small intestines, 80% gets destroyed in the liver. And we know usually 5 or 15% are getting into the bloodstream. Well, this is pure 100% glucose made by your saliva. And honey is immediately absorbed in the body. It doesn't even have to be changed. It can go in as straight glucose and vitamins and all that stuff, you know, from your local flowers. It's the only, you can put it on your skin and it'll go in. Honey's does not have to be digested, in other words. It's so pure. Well, when this honey converts and your saliva converts a carbohydrate and alkaloids, that's all a mushroom is carbohydrates and alkaloids. There's no protein there. So they convert that to pure glucose, goes to a maltose first, then the glucose in your gums and the roof of your mouth, send it straight to your brain and your spine. It goes straight back to your spine and straight to your brain. And the inner cheeks of your mouth, what are called part of buccal administration, goes straight to the ventral aorta of your heart. It goes straight to your ventral aorta of your heart to be pumped everywhere in your body. Now, you reach a certain point when you keep eating this. I might stop for a second. I never spit any out or swallow any unless I'd much rather swallow than spitting it out. But anyway, to maybe drink a glass of water, drink some pure spring water. And then I start eating more and more. And it gets to a point where my body's really humming and I feel it's really good. And a lot of times the spine starts vibrating. Then you can feel the vibration of your spine healing your body. And it's like getting up from this, I don't know, being physically healed, because you can feel yourself breathing and holding your breath for a second or two against your spine and watching your breath go up and down your spine and breathing deep and your breath going up and down your spine. And it's like Quetzalcoatl's healing you or something. And then all of a sudden you're in this spiral, or you see Quetzalcoatl coming. And it's like this type of millennial energy was just, that's why they call it the rainbow plume serpent. All these people have it. The oldest civilizations, the Olmecs, and the Mayans got Quetzalcoatl drawn in caves. And you can easily, this book we're talking about, the Yuta Tota Codex, this goes into from a religion way back to then, because the Toltecs either conquered or interacted and became friends with the Mayans. And it was supposedly Quetzalcoatl, a human king that invented this ceremony, went down there and started Culiacan. And the Mayans started Culiacan from this because of the original Toltec king. And he ended war between tribes and he ended human sacrifice in Teotihuacan, in the area in there. He had it all built. All that great architect came from one man, all those ideas and artistic things. And then the Toltecs got mad at him because he says, I'm going to share it with all the other tribes around here. And he was sharing his knowledge with all the other tribes and they were getting upset and they were going to drive him out. So that's why he went south to the Mayans and introduced the Culiacan. That's their language. That's Maya. That's Maya for Quetzalcoatl, the white plumed serpent. So in the next scene, you see the trough where the world isn't, the reeds are loose again, but there's dancing below the six time type of persons that can meet you and help you, like Lady Four Eagle. There's all sorts of different names of them, but this is a shamanic dance. This is a dance of witchcraft.
Are we on the top left now?
We're sort of in the middle left when he's diving in.
Okay.
See the guy diving in, his head diving into the trough?
Yes.
Okay. He's going into the underworld for two purposes. To recover his ancestral heritage, like where Quetzalcoatl said to open this world to him. And you see a very special symbol there. This is a symbol of the onset of the mushroom time when it starts. And for the mushroom time, it's the A with the squashed O, and below it is a flint with all these beads going underneath the flint, like to the right, to the left side, really. And above, there's some beads that are headed toward the guy who's done the shamanic dance to go into the underworld. And when he comes out at the bottom, there's also a special sort of symbol for the peak of the experience of when you settle into the mushroom, like when you've entered into the land of the tree of life, and the singing pyramid of the sun arises from the earth. And what you're seeing there, it's really wild. It's Quetzalcoatl is called War Two-Face here. Notice he has two faces.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He has two faces, and he has the five petal note of Venus on his head, the notes, because they really considered and understood that the rotation of Venus and the 2,600 year rotation of the sun in it, orbit in its orbit in the solar system, and the orbit of Venus around the sun, which was a five petaled 8 year event. And then there was three nodes of Venus each day on the earth. And that's being represented by Quetzalcoatl mushrooms. Like the mushrooms have the relationship to Venus when they're shaped like that. Okay. You see him holding his hand there up, and his staff is below. And he was a special avatar shaped. He had shape-shifted into a special avatar, and you have become him. Now, the interesting thing, directly across from him, you see a jaguar, which is Talak, with him porting his finger up, you know, that we have ascended. You've ascended to the singing pyramid of the sun. But actually, it's Talak who shape-shifted into, it's Quetzalcoatl who shape-shifted into Talak. That may seem weird to you, but they considered that Quetzalcoatl, he's shape-shifted, and that's happened to me. I've been in this temple before where I entered into both of them at the same time in a healing ceremony. It was absolutely incredible. You know, it's something I just did at a request for a friend, and I never expected. The thing came right up out of the ground. It was an amazing ceremony. And in this ceremony, you can see below the balance of the feet on the four directions. So you see the ball's in balance now. His foot is balanced instead of it just floating wildly in the pond up above, or the lake up above, the Uttatoda River.
Mm-hmm.
And down below, it's still open to the underworld. That crevice is still open to the underworld anytime they're ready to do it now. But you also have the three reeds tied together. Remember I told you yesterday about how the three reeds are tied together, but there's another hand in there because you're always tying reeds together. You don't ever get there. You're tying reeds together all the time, I guess, until you turn into compost and become a reed, right?
Right. So this would then essentially, it would mark a transition in the sense that you've gone through this shamanic work, you've entered into the underworld, you've tied the reeds of your past together within the present and attaining balance, but of course the future is still coming, so there are more reeds that are going to need to be tied. So in other words, this is an ongoing process of transformation, an ongoing process of healing, an ongoing process of becoming, that there's always becoming.
And what Quetzalcoatl taught was really weird. He taught that he just told the people, you're going to fluctuate through life in pain and love. That's it. You're going to have all sorts of love in your life, and you're going to have all sorts of pain. He says, so figure it out now, right now, and start enjoying it. Just enjoy that you're here above the earth and that you're playing this game. You know, just enjoy it. And he warned a lot of people, especially about knowledge, because he said he had a comment about knowledge, and he was talking about the sacred knowledge and knowing stuff and everything. That he used to say that you have to be incredibly humble. It's really dangerous for a person to think that like this knowledge belongs to him, or he's giving it out, or you know what I mean? just be incredibly, because you might go on, I've been on a VIA with somebody who's in terrible shape, and I learned something about my life in that ceremony from that person. You know, 90% of it was just getting the shit that had happened in her childhood out of her, you know? And then when that got out physically, she went into sort of like the dreamland of Teo Nanakatl, where she rewrote what her life was about, what everything that happened meant. It's all a blessing, right? That's the start of the ceremony. You're blessing whatever for your past life and whatever happened and what happened in the future. And then when you get into the ceremony, you're of this type of thing, you're demanding stuff. You're putting incantations and stuff and asking what the trade-off is here, what's going on, you know? But this ceremony at the bottom technically means that the sun has become a conductor, and it's the sun coming up in the morning of the first dawn of your life. The first dawn of your life, the first dawn of the civilization is coming up, and the sun is the conductor at the tree of life of all the birds, and all the birds are singing in the tree. And the pyramid, which you can go up, is called the Pyramid of the Sun. And the reason it's called the Pyramid of the Sun is because it is the great conductor of life on Earth, not as a god, but as a living emanation force in nature. You know what I mean? Just like you call Hurricane Donna. If we give it a name as an avatar that we knew to talk about her, we don't think that name is Hurricane Donna. You know, I've been in Hurricane Donna. I know what Hurricane Donna was like, but it's still that super power force of nature.
Right.
And this is what you're tapping into when you have these emanations and you see weaving between people, this type of weaving and the three different types of emanations, the bouncing type of emanations, and the people see it between plants, people see it between animals and plants, or especially between plants and people. And that's what the weaving type of it, that's why they considered women who wove to be sorcerers. Really, I'm not kidding you. They considered people that had weaving skills to be sorcerers because they considered they were putting that into what they were weaving. That goes beyond Western thinking, you know. I mean, it's a whole different world of way because they expect the ancestral family to heal whoever has a problem. And the spirits of the past, you know, within the plant that have been a service to the family for histories, you know. And thank God some people have special talents. I mean, Beth Williams wrote an incredible article about talents, Maria Sabina. Besides being special with the mushroom, she had poetic talents, which Howard Munn talks about the uniqueness of how the shaman, the words sprang forth without any thinking about it, you know. So, and that's when she references back to this book and some of her ceremonies that were recorded by Wasson when they're translated. She's referencing back to the book.
This Yuta Tono Codex?
Do that, but everybody knew about it. But the books, but the sacred sages that had it, they were called the Old Cracklers. And the reason they were called the Old Cracklers was because when they moved these old deer skin pages, they would make crackling sounds in the temple because it was accordion-like. It wasn't like an American book. It was, you think of it as it's a book that's accordion-like, right?
And so now you have used this with people. So maybe you could share a little bit about that from your side of sharing this with others and the experiences that they've been having kind of following this map, following this model of using these mushrooms in this way and using the codex itself.
Yeah, I've only given the codex that I've made the big size one to maybe three or four people, George Lake and Jenna Lake, you know, at their wedding, and to Acacia Lewis, who you met, the beautiful young lady, Acacia Lewis, and also you talked to Rose Marie. I think I'm sending one to her. I've sent stuff to her about it. But those, Acacia and Jesse or Jessica Marie, they took the mushroom just exactly like I said, is in this codex. And the thing of it is, you know, everybody, a guru and everybody can promise you all sorts of stuff, right? You're going to enter nirvana, you're going to get this or that, right? All I'm saying, if you take the mushrooms this way, dried or in honey, but this is a method that if you do it, you'll find out for yourself, you know? It's like me telling you, oh, there's a canoe down by the creek. Somebody left paddles in it. I'd suggest you get in the boat. And if you're in the boat, you probably should use the paddles. That's about all I do.
So this work here, the codex, this is the canoe and the paddle.
When you turn into Quetzalcoatl, you know, when you make that motion, when you're actually turning into Quetzalcoatl, it's around everybody that's there. I did in Goblin Valley in Utah one time with a guy that had been in a motorcycle accident, and it was amazing. It was like myself and especially him was swallowed up inside a huge monster snake of rainbow light that was twisting and spinning in spirals. It was just twisting and spinning in spirals. It was unbelievable. I mean, it's like all these diamond jewel bracelets. It comes in so many different ways, but it's always with the colors of the rainbow. You know, to that energy, it's that life force, which I think is the same life force that comes out of when a person's born, when it comes out of the hand of creation, when a baby's born. It's that pure energy, or like a bud springing up. It's like when the thing has been turned to what I told you, a tertiary quid, where you have male and female, but are, you know, life, death, that you've added a separate thing to this. You've added it to the male, female becoming a serpent, you know, the female all seeing eye, disembodied dragon eye, and the serpent of the earth, you know, combining to heal humans, you know, in what they need and what they're calling for, what they're asking for. This is like a plant that has an interaction with individual people, all people and individual people especially. I've seen people have all sorts of powers. I know a guy that could just holographically travel and astral travel. And I asked him to explain it to me, and he said, I just can't explain. I can't explain. There's no verbal explanation of how this happens.
So these are the kinds of potentials that then get unlocked through these ritual use of the mushrooms?
Right. Right, and the main thing that you learn very quickly, and it becomes really scary, the mushroom shows you right away certain paths, you know, and certain people that don't want to change, that want to keep doing what they're doing, it doesn't make a judgment on them, but they know they don't want to come back again wanting to change and deal with what they dealt with before, okay? But then it becomes heavier if anybody ever gets on an ego trip, because that's when the balance comes from the other side, if you know what I mean. Use of the codexes was to interact with the forces that exist in the sky and the earth, the forces of nature. And it's sometimes when I do a ceremony with people with restrooms, we're sitting there close to noon and I'm sitting, the cacao was long ago, and all of a sudden I just feel those forces, and I just start eating then. And there's an ancient ceremony where you drop a little of your own blood onto dried mushrooms, and it's amazing. They sprang up. I ate about the first 10 to 20 grams just dipped in honey. And the only thing I'm doing in between is drinking water. But a lot of this just depends on the ceremony. The longest ceremony I was in recently, I was trying to heal somebody, and I felt like he was healed, that had just lost his wife. And the most amazing part of the ceremony was the woman was in me just letting her sister and son play out in the yard. And I told her, just watch that. Watch them playing out in the yard, really playing, to feel the presence of her still with him and around him, you know, and that life was still there, that all this is going on. And it was so fun. And it was that little kid playing and his sister playing that really did all the healing. Because the mushroom was directing them and putting the energy into them. They hadn't even taken anything. They were just playing, like kids play in a yard.
And that's actually something that you've mentioned a few times, this idea of kind of the joyfulness of all of this. And also in some of the things that you sent me to read, really focusing on entering into this with a state of play, a sense of joyfulness, a sense of celebration, even in that balance of the beautiful things in life and the horrible things in life, the growth and the destruction, the life and the death, but to enter into it with a joyous heart. And so is that then the deified heart, is one that is able to react in balance?
There are 40,000 neurons around your heart. Just the same neurons that are in your brain. People tell you there's neurons all around that are identical to what's in your brain. And these 40,000 neurons around your heart, and there's more nerve links going to your brain than into your spine. And what happens is when you become the mushroom, you go into monosynaptic reflexes. What that means is your brain's whacked out of the picture. Your brain becomes an observer. You know, the conscious and unconscious become an observer. But the monosynaptic reflexes is, take for example, it's cat-like motions like a panther. And that happens when you're, especially when your eye's nictitating membrane pulls back and it loses the muscle tension on your eyeballs. I mean, Schultes and Albert Hofmann, who found psilocybin and invented LSD, wrote about this in a 1972 book. It's simple medical terms if you look them up, but it's all this that creates this motion, that creates this in the body, which is why great athletes work so hard that when they go on the field, they don't have to remember what to do. It's all, you know, like body movement, it's body memory. Mm-hmm. But the motion, the impulse is coming from the outside into the body, going into the spine and back. In other words, everything's going from the spine and body out. It's not happening with the brain. The brain's just an observer. It's like up there watching. It's not conducting anymore. The body wants to heal itself. I hate to tell you this, but the body wants to feel joy. That's why I can't believe this bullshit of taking ignorant Freudian type of people and sticking them in a room in a couch and giving them a pill and charging them $3,500 for maybe 1/8 of what I take and what a normal person probably 1/3 or third of what they take, you know, in with headphones on. And amazing people, they're into this, what McKenna taught that I liked. I liked a lot of McKenna. I'm talking about Terrence, Dennis Spine. Of Jung, the synchronicity. You know, your experience when you're out in the woods, that when a limb breaks, when you're in a certain time space and that limb breaks and hits the ground, or a crow makes a sound, or a bird flies, it's an affirmation of something. It's like something, a direction of what you should move on and how you should act. It's a message to you. People wait to see a sign in nature or something that tells them what to do rather than the sign. They're looking for a sign to come. It's called the hand of God. It's a difference. You can put God in your heart. People today think they can live forever, and these Gnostic religions are ridiculous in that they believe they can escape death. But the whole thing of it is, you know, there it is right there. Right there. And it's a heart, heart-to-heart interface. The emanations between you and the time people. You may be talking verbally to them, and you may be hearing stuff in verbally, but it's the type of emanations between them, and especially between the plants and trees. And that becomes really like magical, that you could start to see it in the woods of certain plants interacting with you. For some reason, that plant likes Martin Ball and wants to have an interaction with him. For whatever reason, I don't know. It could be just curiosity. But these emanations that come out, they come from the time people too, and the people you're asking to work with you. And these codexes are all in museums in Europe. They should come back now. This one's in the Austrian Museum. And the magic of the Topali, when you start understanding the mushroom, you start understanding that these particular mushrooms have a world in themselves, this parallel world. And it was like these ancient sages who Maria Sabina was a Tenalto woman because she was the last bridge back to the Tenalti women. And this bridge was to connect these two worlds together, that they're two parallel worlds. It's obvious to you or you would be nuts. You know when you do that this other world exists, right? And it's that's why you talk to me or somebody like me, because we verify it with each other. So if we go out in the street and tell the normal person, he doesn't think, you know, that we're crazy. So we're a great person with normal people. But if this movement between the worlds, this shift in the continuum is why Western psychologists cannot understand Teilhard-de-Chardin. They can't understand this world because they deny it exists. This is pantheistic monism as a reality. It's what Einstein believed in monism like this. When they ask him, there's only one European philosopher that ever had this, was Spinoza. And they asked Einstein, do you believe in God? He said, well, I believe in Spinoza's God. This God of all this energy, motion flowing in the earth. It's something that we can dealt with the different parts of it with this. And that's what these people who develop this type of metaphysics and ontology. Metaphysics and ontology is how you see the world and how you act in the world. You know, your metaphysics is sort of a smaller part of philosophy, is how you come to understand what the world is. And the ontology is sort of like how you're acting on that, actually living in the world. And in this particular situation, to them, every day was a religious act. Every moment was a religious act that they had to be in this center of balance and balancing themselves, that everything was motion. And the part about enjoying it, that was a good part. But you know, it took work to look for people to learn this stuff. There's an ancient story about this woman who was a sage, a mushroom sage in the temple, and some beggar found a box of jewels. And the box of jewels he found, he brought to her, were jewels of divination, jewels of healing this, cures, all sorts of things, right? And the guy said, I want you to teach me how to use these things in my box. And you'll see that when you go up into the temple of Quetzalcoatl, that these this stuff brought out. And she simply said to him, well, you have to practice, you have to learn this over time, that you have to go through all these experiences, and these are the jewels in there, and blah blah blah, but you know you can't just tell somebody these are jewels and how to use it. And he got mad and was going to kill her. And then all the forces of nature came out of the sky, the ground, the earth, the river, and tore him apart and threw him back into the earth. So this is actually a story of mythos, that the more you do this, the more you learn, right? And I do it to microdose to keep from losing my mind, you know, to play pickleball and to keep my mind sharp rather than stuff Big Pharma sells me like a cap with honey. But I only do ceremonies at times like I feel like it's right, and especially in Florida with it raining right now, I'll probably be out in the beef fields next week. We're finally getting lots of lightning and rain. And that's when you know Talak lightning is actually entering the earth, and that's a belief of a force of the sky, the energy, and you can feel it when it hits the earth around here, when it shakes your house. And that energy is the energy of healing. Now, there's a story in my older book about how a woman healed a young girl, you know, from Talak shaking the mountain with rain. But this story of that energy flowing into the earth, that's where the children of the sun grow from the blood. It's actually the sexual blood from Quetzalcoatl, who is both male and female. And like I told you the other day, a tertiary quid of more than just male and female sexual energy. It has all this rainbow, diamond, dragon, all this other energies of nature in it that the original King Quetzalcoatl discovered. He discovered in a ceremony and taught the Toltecs. And so this is this ceremony being relayed on, like the Salazar in a way. It's for sorcery, it's for shamanism, it's for healing. And that's the thing you won't hear anybody at MAPS talking about which all the anthropologists are starting to talk about that are into South America. It's the time persons and the idea of these time persons. And a book will be coming out real soon from Matthew about these time persons.
To recap, we've been talking about the Yudhitono Codex and about this process of working with the mushrooms to interact with these time persons, these emanations of the energies of nature that are personified and interactive within the mushroom space to help create balance and a joyful heart where the loose reeds of the past have been tied in the present and one is without judgment able to see pathways into the future and choices and behavior to walk as a person in balance between these energies of male and female, creation, destruction, life and death, pleasure and pain, and all the rest of that, all the juicy bits of being human.
Yeah, they believe we came here to awaken dreaming, and that there was sort of like, they believe that there were different parts of us that went on, you know, that it wasn't like your memory that went on, but different sections that you went on, but they believe your life was like a precious flower, that you have a little time here. And that's why at the ceremony, you realize that the self-sacrifice and to help people and to be, you know, a good citizen and to help people and help your neighbor is really what makes a difference in life. That'll make your life the happiness, you know, because then you balance your life and you're not worshiping anything on either side and you're willing to help people if they need some help.
Yeah.
And that's your talent in this parallel world.